You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 267 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello.
Hello. Well, let's get right into it this week. We've got a bit of a theme early, and it starts with this week's beer, which is the Fremont Pride Kolsch. Their description of it: Pride, it's not just about the rainbows, unicorns, and glitter. It's about celebrating queerness and standing up for the safety and self-determination of the LGBTQ+ community. Really, it's all about love. Our goal with this beer is to create and foster a community for LGBTQ+ people and friends in the craft beer world. Be proud of who you are, who you like, and what you drink. A portion of the proceeds of this beer go to funding organizations supporting and fighting for the LGBTQ+ community. Here's to Pride. Here's to you.
There we go.
Yeah. So this was all sold out when we went to Fremont a few weeks ago. And thankfully, they have restocked. And I was back there last night, as we'll talk about later on the pod, and had to pick this up. And just perfectly in time for Pride weekend coming up.
Yes.
Virtually, sadly, this weekend.
I don't think it'll be virtual everywhere.
Okay. The bulk of it is the official programming is virtual.
It would be, if it wasn't virtual, people might die with the heat wave this weekend.
Well, that's true.
Like, I just don't know. It's going to be dangerous out there.
A toast staying on the same two Raiders defensive lineman, Carl Nassib, who became the first active NFL player to identify as gay earlier this week. An awesome step for the NFL. Obviously, we had Michael Sam previously, but for someone who is an established NFL player, is going to be in the league this season, is an excellent development.
I'm pouring this beer very precisely. But I do think you have to look at Michael Sam as somebody who was really pioneering and inspirational in this process of having Carl Nassib, this announcement happen, and having it be a big deal in a positive way. Whereas Michael Sam, I think, was definitely shunned by the NFL.
It was a controversy. There's not been controversy about this announcement.
Yes. Yeah. At the very least, there's that. And I think Michael Sam really suffered from coming out when he did, and has to be really credited as being pioneering in that conversation.
For sure, along with, of course, Jason Collins in the NBA. So, all right, lastly, on this theme, part of the theme, congrats to, from Talkin' Taco Time, Randy Cote on being part of the team that won the inaugural Seattle Pride Classic for hockey. I guess that's not in there. It's the Seattle Pride Hockey Association, as part of Team Marsha, named after Marsha P. Johnson, a trans woman of color who was a prominent force behind the Stonewall riots and surrounding activism that sparked a new phase of the LGBTQ movement in the late 60s.
There we go, Randy.
Yeah. Drinking out of the cup. It was outstanding to see those photos on Instagram.
Oh my God. You know what? I've never won a recreational sporting event, but
he might have just been kissing the cup. I'm not sure if he was drinking. They were drinking out of the cup.
It might be worth it to kiss out of, or to drink out of a cup,
just to get the opportunity to win a recreational sporting event.
Yeah, I know. I said last week that there was no societal benefit to recreational sporting events or whatever, and I guess I don't know if I'm going to go as far as to say that it's a societal benefit to drink out of a giant cup. But at the same time, seeing those photos of Randy, I think we all benefited.
100%. So we'll have to talk about that as part of the next Talkin' Taco Time, or perhaps on a different venture. So we'll see on that. Announcement today, some big developments looking ahead to the fall. The Seahawks and UW, as well as WSU, all announcing full capacity for the upcoming football season. Unvaccinated fans will be required to wear masks at those games.
There we go. How are they going to prove that?
Unclear, because it doesn't sound like they're checking necessarily, as they are at, for example, the Sounders will be opening up the entire lower bowl of Lumen Field, I should say, to vaccinated fans for this week's games. But they are checking.
They are checking.
Yes.
That's good. I mean, they should friggin' check.
I mean, we'll see. That there's also, you know, 2.5 months, or 2 months, I guess, before the preseason, before they have to actually determine this.
Uh-huh. They're also wearing the mask would be like wearing a scarlet mask if you're somebody who's going to those events and they were checking.
I mean, you can still opt to wear the mask even if you're vaccinated.
I assume that there definitely will be people who are. It's like when I go to the grocery store, there are unmasked people at the grocery store now. And for the most part, I'm giving the benefit of the doubt to Fairwood, Washington. For the most part, I assume that those people are vaccinated.
But there's zero chance right now that I'm walking in the grocery store without a mask.
Oh, and that's the same. It's like I'm vaccinated and also wearing a mask in the grocery store.
It is probably the issue is that the people who are most likely to continue wearing a mask are people who are also most likely to get vaccinated.
Exactly.
There is an overlap there. Yes. There's a correlation. But yeah, I drove past Husky Stadium last night as part of this journey in the North End and, you know, was thinking about the fall. I don't want to say I'm looking forward to it because I don't like fall weather as much, but you know, we talked about this when we were talking about the hypothetical Huskies hosting a game in the first round of the playoffs.
When we did the Pelton Cast search for the Seattle's best season.
Yes. September weather is much better than your hypothetical third weekend of December game. But still, and actually maybe at this point, September weather sounds preferable to what we've got coming over the next week here. But still, I don't necessarily want to jump ahead, but was thinking about how excited it will be to get back there this fall.
There we go.
All right, next up, congrats to Sue Bird, Joel Lloyd, and Brianna Stewart for all being named to the U.S. Women's National Team for the Olympics. Bird and her backcourt mate, Diana Taurasi, going for an unprecedented fifth gold medal apiece, while Stewart is aiming for number two, and Lloyd heading to the Olympics for the first time after representing the USA at the 2018 FIBA World Cup. Storm will also have Ezzie Magbegor and Stephanie Talbot on the Australian Opals squad for the Olympics, while Katie Lou Samuelson is expected to be part of the USA basketball 3x3 team, which hasn't yet been named.
All right. Is Diana Taurasi retired from the WNBA?
No, she's still playing. She's still been playing. Injured lately. She's coming back this weekend. Not playing as well as Sue, who is in the top 10 by wins above replacement player.
Wow!
You know, over 2 years after you pronounced her career over.
It's pretty incredible.
Playing some of the best basketball of that entire career at age 40. Sue's the best. Stewart also named WNBA Western Conference Player of the Week again. It is the second consecutive honor for her, the third time in 5 weeks this season, and the fourth for the Storm in those 5 weeks.
I mean, Brianna Stewart's like a virtual lock to win the MVP at this point, right? Or no?
The fact that Jonquel Jones, who was the other frontrunner, has missed so much time is definitely strengthening Stewie's case and is going to continue to miss time because Bosnia and Herzegovina advances. It keeps advancing in Eurobasket, which is more evidence of how valuable Jonquel Jones is. But
Jonquel Jones is from Bosnia and Herzegovina?
No, she is not, but she represents them internationally.
Really?
I mean, there's a lot of players in the WNBA and the women's basketball community who get passports to various countries. And this happens on the men's side as well, but it's usually a lower caliber of players because what it allows you to do is in European competition, you count as a domestic player instead of an imported player for the limits there. So you get more money when you play overseas, and in return, you go play for Bosnia and Herzegovina during a tournament during the WNBA season.
Pretty funny.
So,
but she didn't want to play for the U.S. team? It wasn't...
She is not American.
Oh.
I want to say Bahamas, but don't quote me on that. Okay. Lastly, wanted to mention, before we get started here, I forgot to mention this last week, which was ridiculous. If you haven't already, be sure to check out the podcast I did last week with both Coach George Karl and then-President GM Wally Walker, looking back on the 25th anniversary of the Sonics team that reached the NBA Finals in 1996. So some interesting stuff, particularly some behind-the-scenes anecdotes from Wally that was a lot of fun. Hope everyone enjoyed those who listened to them. You have nothing to add here because you did not listen.
I haven't yet.
Well, should we talk about
food?
We'll
see if I get to it.
And resume our search for Seattle's best fried chicken.
Sure. You put it on the rewatchables feed and then I'll listen.
No, I'm going
to
miss.
If you could get Chris Ryan to comment on your podcast.
Brad Koppelman also talked
about it. I would definitely cue that up. Or Mina Kimes sometimes. Really any of the cast of characters.
I mean, Mina's more plausible. I don't know if she has memories of the 96 Sonics. So we resumed our search this week for Seattle's best fried chicken at Chimak, which is a Korean fried chicken restaurant. Their description, inspired by the national dining and culture in pastime, we created Chimak, chi short for chicken in English, and mak short for beer or mikju in Korean as a way to bring this uniquely Korean-American experience and delicacy to Seattle, where East and West go together, like chicken and beer.
I was going to ask you what. I pronounce it Shimak, so.
That's how I pronounced it in the past, too, but after reading this explanation, since it's based on chicken, I assume we're supposed to go with Shimak.
Yeah, that makes sense.
This restaurant opened on the Ave in late 2017, and I'm pretty sure that Katie and I went there into December 2017 after UW's 27-point loss at home to Gonzaga. And we talked about going back for a football pre-funk and partaking in one of their specialties is the combination of soju. Is the makju? I can't remember what that's. But the combination of soju and beer mm-hmm. is what they do. They have that on tap together. But never made it back during those UW football seasons. Chimak opened a second location in Bellevue in early 2020. So this is my first time having their fried chicken. I think we had wings the time I went there before.
Yeah, I didn't go. I've never been.
And they were, I remember they were notably spicy is one of my main recollections. But also I'm surprised I ate because I definitely went to Maono before that game. So there was a lot of eating for that one.
Well, so in keeping with the theme of the podcast, the fried chicken, they call it their Pride Fried Chicken, which I looked at that and I was like, wait, did they rebrand this for this weekend?
I assume it's more like they take pride in it.
Yes. Yeah. It was just pretty funny because that's what was in my head. Given yes. what we were talking about. It's like, oh, the Pride Fried Chicken. I'm not sure about that. But then I figure it's a permanent name.
So we both did the half fried chicken, 5 pieces.
And then Mrs. Fantasy Genius got the popcorn chicken, so I tried some of that as well.
Nice.
You went to the Seattle location.
I did.
I went to the Bellevue location, which is in Factoria.
Okay.
It's sort of, I don't know how familiar you are with Factoria.
I was tempted to break out in song in reference to East Side Story, yes. the classic yes. almost live sketch.
But there's a Sufjan Stevens song where they sing Peoria yes. and every single time it's just Factoria, yes. right? But
that actually was what I was going to do. It wasn't even going to be a reference to the old slime. That was a different thing what they did.
You've got a lot going on in there with yeah. Factoria in yeah. your head. Just, very little of it, I assume, has to do with actually going to the mall.
Oh, no.
So it's,
the last time I went, I'm pretty sure, to Factoria is when we had dumplings.
Yeah, we had Factoria. Those dumplings in the mall.
Yeah.
It's across the street from there near the QFC, sort of like in that same complex. And, you know, it's basically in a strip mall. You mm-hmm. know, it's a little bit of a weird location to be. And I'm just going to be totally honest from the jump. I was kind of let down by Chimak during this. I went into this with pretty high expectations for this chicken. And it's not that it wasn't good. It was good, but I thought they would potentially be a contender for Seattle's best chicken. And after having it, I think it stops at good for me.
See, that's fascinating because I thought they were a plausible contender, and I was kind of counting on you to either confirm or deny that idea, and you've gone the deny direction. So what stood out? Because I mean, to me, you know, the quality of the frying was very strong. The flavor wasn't overwhelming, but it was definitely there, so much so that they provided dipping sauce with even just the straight fried chicken order, and I utilized that a little bit, but I didn't feel like I needed a lot of it.
No, having a dipping sauce is good, but the chicken should taste good on its own.
Of course.
I think that's the main thing. It's like when we've judged, there's the gravy that we've had in the past. You've got syrup at various different places. But the most important thing should be that the fried chicken on its own is very good. And then if you have something that's going to elevate it, that's great. But you can't fake it in Seattle's search for the best fried, in the search for Seattle's best fried chicken. So I had an order scheduled for 7 o'clock p.m. I had it in my hand by 7:09 p.m. And I checked those times because it was completely dried out on the inside.
Really?
And look, maybe they made it early, which if I would have arrived super late, then I think that's a fault of my own.
Correct.
But I think 9 minutes in a package, the food should be still very fresh.
Yeah, I mean, I waited longer than that because I probably got there 5 minutes after my order was placed for. But then I drove because I went to eat at Ravenna Brewing and it took a while to get over there and park and get in there. So it was at least a solid 15 minutes before I ate mine.
And it was pretty much the same with the popcorn chicken that I had after. I mean, I think the fry was good on it, but even the flavor coming out of the chicken, especially after the location that we're going to be talking about in a second from Portland, the flavor in the chicken itself. That you kind of have two different flavors that exist, right? It's how much have you actually brined this chicken? How much flavor are you getting from the chicken itself? And then how much are you getting from the fried? It's a little bit easier to get flavor from the fried than it is from the chicken, right? And it's more common that way.
For sure.
But I think truly excellent fried chicken, every single part of it has a good and strong flavor. And to me, I thought all parts of it were maybe average, above average. The thing that it reminded me the most of was grocery store chicken.
The one thing I wonder about is whether this Bellevue location, this Factoria location, is not turning out as good chicken as the original flagship location.
Certainly could be.
In the U District. That's a fascinating casualty of the fact that we went to different locations.
Or, I mean, maybe they prepared it way before I was supposed to pick it up. Like, that's the only other thing that I can assume.
Well, maybe we'll have to get back to that location this fall at some point. And then you can try that and compare. Because it doesn't sound like this is going to make the finals of our search here.
Well, and especially just getting it super fresh. I mean, I understand takeout's a different experience, but we've been eating every single one of these chickens takeout. So it's not like, you know, we're kind of comparing them chicken to chicken here.
Instead of apples to apples, it's chickens to chickens.
Yes. And I also don't think that this was a situation where they didn't get a fair shake, if that makes sense.
My score for them was an 88.
I'm more like an 80.
Okay. Well, we're getting down to it, as we talked about last week. We got a handful of locations left, but we'll continue our search. We may also have to do some more Korean fried chicken, because I'm told that Mr. Chicken in the International District, it's very hot right now. That's the word on the street.
Mr. Chicken's hot?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
I don't know about next week. So you talked about the chicken that you had recently. You went back to Portland. You rectified your lack of chicken from your last Portland trip.
My lack of chicken?
Yes.
My no chicken Portland trip? Well, so I went to Mama Bird, the place that you'd been to, which basically is fried everything, right? Or grilled everything. It's grilled chicken. It's grilled vegetables. It's grilled strawberries, right? Like, everything's grilled. It's all grilled.
That's what they do.
And it was pretty incredible, the Mama Bird. But the most exciting thing to me, look, I love grilled chicken on its own, but the amount of flavor that they got out of the grilled chicken, incredible.
Yeah. That's pretty much my takeaway.
And it's like, with a grilled chicken, it's easier to have a dipping sauce with it.
Which sauce did you go with?
I got the hot sauce, which is like a hot honey mustard.
Okay.
It was pretty spicy. I'm not sure. I'm not 100% sure if I would get that again. It was fine, but it was just like, I didn't need that. I was good. I was good with the chicken unto its own.
Correct.
I thought the whole experience was great. The grilled sweet potatoes were amazing. The chicken was amazing. The freaking salted chocolate chip cookie. By the way, is this just a standard that we live in 2021 where every single chocolate chip cookie you get is salted now? Because that is something I can get behind. This is progress, people.
Wow, finally you've found an example of capitalism you like.
Some people say that time is a flat circle and we are not living in a specific time. But I say things are constantly getting better every single day. We are making progress because we are putting salt on our chocolate chip cookies. Thank you.
There you go.
But it was a great experience. Also in Portland, just to run through this quickly, I tried to go to Screen Door. And so I was looking at Screen Door to order takeout. And I pulled it up, and I didn't realize you couldn't just like get it within 30 minutes or whatever. And it was like,
didn't I recount this experience on the podcast to you? I mean, I know you don't, but usually it's like the Sounders section.
You were talking about what the Mariners record was, and you were like, so the Mariners are 27-26. Anyway, you have to order way ahead at.
I told you, like, I was late for the Blazers game because of the fact that it took me so long. Now, that was on a Friday night, but Sunday morning brunch, I'm sure, is quite popular as well.
But wait, so what did you do?
I just waited.
I don't understand. Because I was trying to put it in the order, and it was like next available order, and it was like an hour and a half away. And
see, then, like, it didn't tell me what the next available order was, so I didn't realize how long the wait was at that point. Oh. Maybe they're doing that to limit capacity or something. I don't know.
And then I was like, next available order, and then it was just like Monday at 1:15 p.m.
That's odd.
So I think they were just like friggin' smashed.
Which did you try to go to the the classic location on Burnside, or did you yes. try to go to the new Pearl location?
The Burnside location. Okay. Both weren't. Neither could do it.
You did check both.
Yeah, the Pearl one initially, it was just like from the get-go, I couldn't even get in there. But then the Burnside one was too long. So again, no screen door. But I will say, I've always been pretty let down. I had Lardo sandwiches for lunch on Sunday. And I've always been pretty, I like Lardo, but it's never been like, this is a transformative sandwich experience. And I had by far the best food that I've ever had at Lardo before.
What did you go with?
I had, it's called the Coney, which is like a cheeseburger with chili on it. It's like a chili cheeseburger. It was fucking incredible.
I mean, that sounds great.
Oh, it was phenomenal.
I was going to say on the Mama Bird that the listener, Mike Jeremiah, went there and said, thanks for the recommendation. So we're 3 for 3 so far on positive reviews on Mama Bird on this podcast.
Well, and when I was in Portland, it was really interesting because people kept asking me, Tristan, what's the latest on the Portland Trail Blazers head coaching search? And I was like, well, I'll have to ask ESPN's Kevin Pelton on a podcast later this week.
So they are moving to another round of interviews. My colleague Adrian Wojnarowski reported that was D'Antoni part of that list? Billups and Hammond are definitely, Becky Hammond becomes the first coach to advance to that next round of interviews, female coach. And Chauncey Billups is part of that list. And I think Mike D'Antoni is too. I think he's the third person that is known to be part of that group.
It's a pretty exciting group of coaches, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting in terms of, you know, potentially two first-time head coaches in Billups, who has been discussed a lot with this candidacy, with this vacancy, is someone that Damian Lillard has expressed his endorsement for.
So Damian Lillard wants a like recent ex-player.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true. Yeah.
But Becky Hammond may also fit that description.
Could perhaps. And then D'Antoni, I mean, it's an interesting example because Neil Olshay's whole thing at the press conference after the season was, we need someone that's going to hold players accountable on defense every day, which is not what you think of with Mike D'Antoni. But Mike D'Antoni, there was a very similar situation as I wrote about when they mutually parted ways with Terry Stotts. When Houston had its coaching search in, I want to say this was 2015 or 16, everyone assumed they were going to hire this defensive-minded coach. Jeff Van Gundy was mentioned because they were much better on offense than defense. And instead, they hired D'Antoni. They added Eric Gordon and Ryan Anderson. They kind of doubled down on offense around James Harden and got to the Western Conference Finals that season. So that was 2016. And eventually, their defense did improve. They brought in Jeff Bedzelic as a defensive coordinator, added Chris Paul and PJ Tucker, and the defense the year that they made it to the Western Conference Finals and were one win away from probably winning the championship was quite strong. It's interesting because D'Antoni has really moved to a switch-heavy system, and that wouldn't be a fit for Portland's personnel. If you've got Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, and Jusuf Nurkic, I don't think the first thing you're looking to do is switch a lot. Uh-huh. So it'd be interesting to see how he'd approach it defensively. But those are the three that are known to have advanced to second interviews at this point.
I think I'm fascinated with any of those three. I'd be pretty excited about any of them.
For sure.
What about the draft lottery that was held earlier tonight? If you're viewing this through a prism of fuck the Thunder, which the whole thing may be a construct, but fuck the Thunder.
The lottery is definitely a construct.
The lottery may be a construct.
Well, things did not go well for the Oklahoma City Thunder in Tuesday night's lottery. The Houston Rockets moved into the top four, retained their pick, ended up with the number 2 overall pick. So the Thunder, therefore, not able to swap that, which was top four protected. They would have been able to swap it with Miami's pick, which is 18th.
Whoa.
And then the Thunder's own pick, which had a reasonably good chance of ending up in the top four, they slide down a couple of spots to number 6. So it wasn't quite the worst case scenario for the Thunder, but it was far from the best case scenario, where there was a possibility if Houston had ended up 5 and Oklahoma City could have gotten the number 1 pick with its own pick, and they could have walked away with 2 top 5 picks in this year's draft. Instead, none in what's considered, you know, a draft with a drop off after the top 5. I'm not sure I agree with that, but that's how it's considered.
There we go.
So they do now have 3 first-round picks in this year's draft after making the Kemba Walker-Al Horford trade.
But none of those, I mean, they're pretty diminishing returns on first-round picks at some point, right?
Probably.
You will have to ask an expert on that.
I mean, it's harder to theoretically model the diminishing returns.
Let's see if we can get Mike Schmitz on the phone.
Oh, no. God. I'm just saying people like assume that's the case. And yeah, logically, there probably is diminishing returns because at some point you've only got so many roster spots. But I don't know that anyone has gone through and found the evidence for it.
Well, even throughout the draft, though, is that that's specifically what I mean, is that having the first, second, or third pick or whatever is infinitely more valuable than having the 18th pick. Just because they're part of the first round doesn't mean that they necessarily have anything in common with each other.
I mean, my research has found that in the NFL, teams overvalue the high picks relative to later ones.
What so, about in the NBA, though?
That's why I said it's similar to the NFL. Oh. Like, it's well, everyone knows that exists in the NFL, that that's why you want John Schneider to trade down. People don't know about it in the same way in the NBA, but my research has found the same thing.
That people overvalue high picks.
Yes. I mean, you definitely want one of the high picks. Like, your chances of getting a superstar are, in fact, much higher from those spots. But if you look at, obviously, Damian Lillard was the 6th pick. A lot of the best players in the league, Paul George, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Rudy Gobert, Nikola Jokic, the MVP, got drafted in the 2nd round. I know you don't recognize him as your MVP.
Your MVP got drafted
in the 2nd round. But my MVP got drafted in the 2nd round.
My MVP was the 6th pick.
Kawhi, did I mention Kawhi? I don't know. I mean, like, these are all players that were drafted in the middle of the first round to the back half of the Donovan Mitchell. Devin Booker was a little higher, but he was like the 9th pick, I want to say. So
obviously very good players are drafted outside of the top 5 picks.
Your chances are lower, but they're far from zero. And the more you know, the more opportunities you have, the more likely it is that one of those is going to hit. The comparison I used when I was talking with someone about the Kemba Walker Al Horford trade and the diminishing returns to picks is, so this was another example of something that I think Sam Presti pioneered. Maybe someone did it beforehand, but in 2007, while the team was still in Seattle, he got 2 first-round picks from Phoenix to take Kurt Thomas's contract so the Suns could duck the luxury tax. Uh-huh. Then at the trade deadline, he turns around and trades Kurt Thomas to San Antonio and gets another first-round pick for Kurt Thomas, a total of 3 first-round picks for Kurt Thomas. And 2 of those picks came to nothing. One of them was used on, I believe they traded up for Cole Aldrich. The other was used to draft Byron Mullins after they moved down a spot. But the 3rd of those picks was Serge Ibaka. Mm-hmm. And if you hit 1 on 3, you're in pretty good shape. If you have 3 first round picks.
But it does feel like the whole point of having all these picks, right? Like with Philly, what they did is, and I understand that their process was very, very different than Oklahoma City's. They didn't have anywhere near the kind of assets that Oklahoma City has as far as draft capital or whatever. But the goal is kind of always pointing toward trying to get a top pick, using a bunch of lower picks to get a top pick, because you just can't, in an NBA roster, you can't draft 3 players in the first round every single season.
I mean, it's eventually consolidating those, and they did that both in the Jason Tatum trade, the Jason Tatum Markel Fultz trade, and then in the Jimmy Butler trade and the Tobias Harris trade. Now, the kind of value they got in some of those deals was pretty questionable, but yes.
It's basically like the goal is you take a bunch of assets and you turn them into one very good asset.
Ideally, yes.
Or what you hope is one very good asset. So if you're what you're telling me is that picks at the top aren't actually as valuable as picks that are lower.
They are. They're more valuable. It's just they're not as much more valuable as it seems.
Okay.
All right. Should we talk about Seattle sports? Let's start with the Kraken, who named former NHL player JT Brown as their first color analyst. The most outstanding player of the 2011 Frozen Four, he led Minnesota Duluth.
Oh, that was a big one.
To the national championship. Brown spent, I believe it's 9 seasons in the NHL. 8 or 9 in the NHL. I did not fill that in. With the Tampa Bay Lightning, Anaheim Ducks, and Minnesota Wild, and most recently played for IF Bjorklöven, which is not an NHL team. just so you know. Because I know you're unclear on that. That's Björklöven. Brown also known for
the Björklöven stars.
Brown also known for protesting police brutality by raising a fist during the national anthem beginning in 2017, a move that was inspired by the acquittal that June of the police officer who killed Philando Castile in 2016 in Brown's native Minnesota. His work championing inclusion landed him on the NHL's Fan Inclusion Committee. So certainly in keeping with the Kraken's theme of diversity and inclusion. This hiring.
And is that something that is common throughout the NHL, or is that...
They're moving in that direction, but no, not historically.
All right.
I would not say. The Kraken are definitely taking a leadership role on that within the league. It would be accurate to say, I think.
Wow.
Is an NHL expert.
Do you think the Kraken are taking a leadership role among social justice with regards to how the organization can present it?
I think that definitely is part of their plans, yeah. I mean, they mentioned that this was part of kind of what drew them to him as a candidate. And so he was playing, like, most recently was this spring, but decided to retire immediately and hang up his skates to take this role as a color analyst. Sounders back in action after the international break on Saturday. A come-from-behind 2-1 win at LA Galaxy. Sasha Kleischen penalty kick gave the host Galaxy the lead in the 21st minute. Sounders came back to tie the match before halftime through a Yaimar Gomez Andrade header on a corner and then took the lead for good when Raul Ruiz Diaz slotted home a rebound in the 49th minute. With Nuhu unavailable due to injury and Javier Arriaga playing in Copa America with Ecuador, newly signed 21-year-old Abdoulaye Sissoko made his debut as a starting center back in this one.
Wow.
Solid performance, I think, from him as part of this defense that has played well all season.
The Sissoko name is huge throughout soccer also.
Yes. Sounders back home this week for two matches. On Wednesday night, they'll host Real Salt Lake, who comes in fourth in the West so far with 1.71 points per match. On Saturday, it's a derby match in the Cascadia Cup against Vancouver, who is tied for last in the West with just 0.88 points per match. 538 Soccer Power Index rates both of these teams in the MLS bottom five, despite that impressive start for Salt Lake. Rain suffered on the wrong side of a 2-1 scoreline Saturday at the North Carolina Courage. And then I got to update the final score here. They were leading the Chicago Red Stars 2-0 last I saw as they played on Tuesday night at Cheney Stadium, and indeed capped that with the earliest goal in franchise history in the first minute.
There we go.
Shirley Cruz got on the board with Bethany Belser, doubling the lead as the Rain snapped a three-match losing streak. Also saw Megan Rapinoe return to the lineup in the 57th minute as a substitute after her time with the U.S. Women's National Team. We still have not yet seen Rose Lavelle since she injured her left ankle while playing with the national team. But OL Rain did see the debuts of goalkeeper Sarah Bouadi and attacker Jennifer Marochan on Saturday. They've started both of these two matches for the Rain, who are looking to build a little momentum with this victory.
Wow. Spelling Jennifer that way.
Seattle Storm.
Wait. Before then, we have to revisit a segment we have not talked about for years.
It has
been a long time. We're even talking about a tournament that is not even being played in the year it is.
And that's talking about Italian soccer.
Italian soccer. The Euro 2020.
So the listener may recall in 2018 us discussing that we didn't have a team in the World Cup because neither Italy nor the USA managed to qualify for that one. It was a real rough World Cup for us.
Did we talk about the U.S. victory against Mexico a couple weeks ago? I don't think we did,
right? We did not,
no. Oh, well, maybe we'll throw some U.S. soccer in there, too.
Okay. That was in the Nations League final?
It was something.
I think that's what that was.
It was pretty impressive.
Okay. So yeah, Italy is back in the Euro. They've qualified for this tournament, and so far perhaps the most impressive team through their first three matches. They hosted the opening match at the Olympic Stadium, Stadio Olimpico in Rome, and have won all three matches by a 7-0 scoreline, 3-0 in both of their first two games, 1-0 in the third game, with not a lot to play for. Actually,
they got to 2-0. I think you're wrong with that. They didn't score two goals in that last game?
I don't think so.
All right.
playing. They rotated eight players, including getting Marco Verratti back in the lineup from injury, but have not allowed a goal in any of their last 11, or I believe 11 matches, all of them wins, and a 30-match unbeaten streak for Italy.
I guess so, that was only 1-0.
Some impressive stats they're putting up here.
Well, so we went into Sunday playing Wales in the last match. Wales seemed pretty good. They did move on in the group. You said that Italy should try to lose this match to be on the opposite side of the bracket from Belgium, the number one ranked team in the world.
I watched Belgium play, I guess that was yesterday, and it did not dissuade me from that opinion.
Belgium is scary?
Yeah, especially, like, I guess it sounds like Giorgio Chiellini should be back for the knockout stages, but he definitely better be healthy to match up with Lukaku. You're going to need him, both him and Bonucci, to deal with Lukaku.
I mean, we went into this match, and, you know, Italy has spent a chunk of time a bit wayward, right? Has always been very good, but there's been a period, including missing the last World Cup, where it's like...
I would say probably since the... I mean, they did fine in the 2016 Euro.
But since the 2016 Euro, like... There's been
well, there's not that many major competitions since the 2016 Euro.
Well, there's the World Cup.
Yeah, and they did terribly in qualifying.
Missing the World Cup, but they've also been kind of middling during that time period. This is the first time that I feel like we've looked at this Italian club and said to ourselves, they are a legit contender for the Euro.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel like they're getting by on smoke and mirrors or getting lucky or whatever, right? There's no wonder strikes. I think that was a previous, maybe that was the 2016 Euro. It was like Bonucci, I think, had a ball where he just like dropped it in for a goal. But it was a little bit of like, this is not sustainable. There's not a real attack here, which is always the issue with Italian soccer, is that there's never an attack. But I think the midfield play and the way that they've been able to dominate and also getting the ball into the net in these matches has been very un-Italian of how they've been playing so far.
They're playing a different style. They're playing much more like Spain.
It is a very Spanish
possession game.
It's a huge possession, making opportunities. We barely even had to see Donnarumma, though.
He has not been tested at all.
So, I mean, I have nothing but the utmost confidence in him, but like, have not had to see much of anything. There is like 1 to 2 balls during those first three matches where it's like, oh, that they could score here.
I mean, yeah, that's the big question, is this team doesn't necessarily, like, it's a squad full of solid players, but you don't have that one star on the level of, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo carrying Portugal in 2016 in the Euro, or on the level of Lukaku.
Or Mbappe.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the World Cup.
Yeah, those kind of talents. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is that Ciro Immobile has been that kind of scorer in Serie A, and it's kind of a matter of him translating it over to the national team, and we have seen that in the first couple matches that he played here.
We've also seen it repeatedly with Italian soccer, the prejudice that exists on the international level against Italian soccer stars. And you know what? Italian soccer players continue to play well in these tournaments, aside from the 2018 World Cup, but
with the notable exception,
play poorly in the 2018 World Cup.
Oh, that's true.
Did not participate, but it is. It's
technically
not
that's only the World Cup final. The qualifying is part of the World Cup technically. So yes, they did play poorly.
It's the World Cup. They have not been a flashy squad in the same way in the 2006 World Cup team. Right, like they didn't come into that as the favorite. There were no strikers that you would say to yourself, these are not the stars who are playing for Manchester City and Manchester United and Liverpool and
City
Barcelona.
Even that big of a deal in 2006? I guess.
But I'm saying City now and those clubs then and Barcelona and places like that, right? It was really just Cannavaro was playing.
Well,
and
everybody
Real Madrid.
Literally everyone on that squad played in Italy.
Cannavaro went
to
Real Madrid like the year after or something.
Well, yeah, because the other thing that was the backdrop for that was that Serie A scandal, which resulted in Juventus getting dropped down to a lower level.
I'm gonna give you a take. This is not. It's not great because they actually succeeded at a very high level, but Italy is the Portland Trailblazers of soccer. Just constantly underrated and always exceeding expectations.
What
including
a weird coincidence that you've considered teams that you follow to constantly be underrated.
I don't think the Seahawks are underrated. Wildly overrated most of the time.
Mariners usually not underrated.
Yeah.
barely underrated.
Very overrated by record. But you go into this and Austria coming up next.
Yep.
Assuming that everything goes chalk, it's the showdown with Belgium.
I don't want to jump ahead. If that takes place, I believe it would be after we pod next. That's how I've planned our beer at least. So
I think it's on Sundays.
No, the next match for Italy is on Saturday.
Or it's Saturday to Saturday. It's the 3rd of July would be the game against Belgium.
Okay.
Which, as many people remember, is close, not the exact same day, as the anniversary of in 2006 when on the 4th of July, Italy took down Germany in Germany.
Really, the greatest 4th of July ever was Italy's victory over Germany. It's why we celebrate the holiday. We're just commemorating the 15th anniversary.
I didn't know enough about soccer at the time to realize how big of a deal it was.
You didn't?
I don't know. It seemed like a big deal, but it was just like, I mean, I'd sort of peripherally...
The host nation and like one of the biggest historical rivals for Italy. Like...
I'd peripherally paid attention to Italian soccer, and it seemed like they were constantly in the World Cup final. So it was like every single time before 2006 that I paid any attention to Italian soccer, it was because they were in the World Cup final.
If a listener wants a brief history of us following Italian soccer because of our Italian heritage, I got into it during the 94 World Cup, got it when they went to the final and lost to Brazil on penalties. And then remember watching the 98 World Cup. I think you had to watch on Telemundo at that point. I definitely was in Spanish language. And
this was in France, right?
Yeah, getting up at like 6 a.m. to watch them play France in France and lose on PKs in that one. Do not have any memories of 2002 because the timing of those
matches. We were at a Mariners game, I swear, when the World Cup final happened in 2002.
No, that was 94.
Oh, that was 94?
Yeah, I mean, in 2002, they would have been in T-Mobile Park.
No, we would have been in a Mariners game.
Yeah, obviously. 2002, those games were all played in the middle of the night, so I don't really remember almost anything from that World Cup. Japan and Korea, I believe, co-hosted that one, if I'm recalling correctly. But 2006 was when we got into it, and that was the first time I was probably more into it beforehand than you were, and both of us got into it. And then every major competition since, including the Euros since then.
And all of my children are now named after Italian soccer players.
That is true.
There was a goal, an assisted Marco to Matteo goal.
It's just a shame that Luca Toni isn't still
on
out
Sunday.
There.
And me and Mrs. Fantasy Genius have a disagreement about who Luca's named after. I say it's the Disney Pixar film that came out when he was 9.
of course.
She says it's for the city of Luca. And she was like, yeah, Luca Toni spelled with 2 C's and the city is spelled with 1 C. And I'm like, I hate to correct you. I'm like, I know how Luca Toni's name is spelled and I know how the city of Luca is spelled and I know who Luca's named after.
The first time you have ever been correct in an argument with Mrs. Fantasy Genius.
I know for a fact who Luca's named after, and that is the great Luca Toni. Legend. Anyway, feeling pretty good. So far, I guess at the very least, I think Austria struggled. I only saw their first match where they were wearing the very striking jerseys.
They were wearing black and like
teal.
Marine, aquamarine.
Yeah. I mean, I know that they have David Alaba, who's...
Alaba.
Alaba.
Which is disappointing that Italy is facing them because Alaba has been one of my favorite players to watch in this tournament. And Belgium is like my other team. Because of the Everton connections with Roberto Martinez and Lukaku.
Bullshit. There's no other team. The only other team that I'm willing to accept is actually U.S. soccer, which I hated for years. And as with all things...
I have some coworkers that are still upset with me cheering for Italy over the U.S. in...
We played them in 06.
The Confederations Cup?
Oh, yeah.
That was too early for me to have watched it with my coworkers. But yes, they did play in the group stages in 06.
They played 2 times like consecutively.
And the US drew Italy in 06, right? I'm pretty sure that happened.
Lost because of what's his name, the American who played there. Remember who played for it in the Confederations Cup? Who was
Oh yeah. Yeah.
He seemed like he was gonna be really exciting.
Yeah. I can't remember what his name was anymore.
It's
though.
Gone now.
Yeah.
We drew with the U.S.
I know. It's shocking. God.
Sickening, really. But now you see Weston McKennie scoring goals for Juventus, and I'm like, hell yes.
I mean, it'd be a very different match these days.
Right? Like, I mean, look, my allegiances still lie with Italy, but U.S. soccer has a legit generation, like a legit exciting generation of players, which it feels like for the first time in our lives has been the case. And it's like, this could be a generation of players that lead them out of the group stage in the World Cup.
They've been out of the group stage.
I'm just saying, but I'm not.
I believe today was the anniversary of the Dempsey goal, wasn't it?
Donovan goal. I'm not willing to say that they're going to get them any further than that, than out of the group stage.
Well, that wouldn't be further than they've been before, so I don't think that's.
But this feels like the
Rossi.
Start. Oh,
was it Giuseppe Rossi?
Giuseppe Rossi. Yep.
Yeah.
This feels like the start of what could become, like, if the U.S. wanted to be, if kids in the U.S. cared about soccer, the U.S. could be the most dominant soccer country in the entire world. I still think we'll look back 100 years from now. We'll all be dead. But I think there could become a time where the U.S. dominates international soccer.
It's certainly possible. But
and if that happens, we will look to this time period as the time period that was the catalyst for everything.
I mean, there's so much more competition among various different sports for the best athletes in the U.S. in a way that is never going to quite be the same, I don't think, in other countries. Like, obviously, there are plenty of players who choose basketball in Europe and in South America now, but there's not a lot that are going to football. There's not a lot that are going to baseball or other sports. So the best athletes are still going to soccer at a rate that I don't think is ever going to be the case in the U.S.
Let me paint you a picture here. The year is 2008. You're eating a chocolate chip cookie.
And there's no salt?
And there's no salt on top. Flash forward to the year 2021. You can't even get a chocolate chip cookie without sea salt on top.
Look at that invisible hand of the market working.
Right? I'm telling you right now. Look, I'll take capitalism if it makes the American soccer better. I feel like soccer might be better under socialism.
I mean, the U.S. actually has a much more socialist structure to their soccer league than Europe. I mean, sports leagues in general, but soccer in particular.
Things change. Sea salt is on chocolate chip cookies now.
The other countries are going to adopt a March to November schedule for their football leagues because they need to get on the same schedule as the U.S. Gonna be a lot of water breaks.
They're all going to have playoffs.
I mean, look, the what was it? The Super League? That was the American style league. It didn't take. Turns out, it got rejected.
I was for it.
All right, let's wrap up talking about the Storm, who completed a 5-in-a-row road trip with their second win over Indiana in 3 days last Thursday, but then came home after an extended break, 4 days off, and suffered their third home loss of the season to the Washington Mystics on Tuesday night. Mystics shot 16 of 38 from three, which is tied for the second most threes in a WNBA game this season. Storm still had two chances to tie in the closing seconds, but Joel Lloyd missed a three and Brianna Stewart a runner as the Mystics held on to get that victory. Storm now 7-0 on the road this season and 5-3 at home at Angel of the Winds Arena. Two of those three losses coming by 4 points or fewer, both of them basically decided in the final seconds. Storm just one game in the week ahead. This is kind of the lightest part of their schedule all year after they played more games than any team in the league in the early stages. Sunday in Las Vegas, the last regular season meeting between the Storm and Aces, who met in last year's WNBA Finals and are atop the WNBA this season with three losses each. Storm, two more wins, so one game ahead in the standings. Connecticut Sun have five losses. Nobody else in the league has fewer than seven. This game also crucial to the race for the inaugural WNBA Commissioner's Cup, which I don't think we've really talked about on the podcast here. Your first game home and away against the other five opponents in your conference counts to the standings for the Commissioner's Cup, which they'll play a final between the winner of the West and the winner of the East before the start of the post-Olympic part of the season. The Storm is the lone undefeated team in Commissioner's Cup play at 5-0 halfway through that schedule. of those five remaining games, the last four are home and home series with both Los Angeles and Phoenix, who they have yet to play this season and should be favored to beat, making this one important because Las Vegas is second in the standings at 3-1 with their lone loss coming to the Storm. So the Storm would take a 2-0 lead in the standings and have the tiebreaker if they win on Sunday. Alternatively, if Las Vegas wins this one, if the teams split these matchups and finish tied in the standings, point differential in all cup games would then be the next tiebreaker. So still some uncertainty, a lot of uncertainty if the Aces win on Sunday. And if the Storm win on Sunday, very likely that they'll be playing for the inaugural Commissioner's Cup this year.
All right.
Lifelong fan of the WNBA Commissioner's Cup. I've always dreamed of it.
You dream as a child of winning the WNBA Commissioner's Cup.
I mean, it's not a real cup because of the fact that these are all just regular season games that also happen to count toward the cup.
Let me ask you
standing.
A question if we're going to call it a cup here.
Okay.
Can you drink out of it?
I don't know. I don't think they've unveiled the actual cup yet.
If literally you're like, it's not a real cup because it's just regular season games. It's a cup if you can drink out of it, and it's not a cup if you can't drink out of it. That's it. That's the line right there. Is there a cup? Can you drink out of it?
Well, it's good to know that the Symmetra Cup was, in fact, something you can drink out of.
The Symmetra Cup?
Yeah, they were the sponsors of the Seattle Pride Classic.
Oh, well, yeah, it was a real tournament because you could drink out of it.
Absolutely.
That's it. That's all you need. To be a real cup. We have no Seahawks talk.
I mean, is there anything to talk about? It does seem increasingly clear that KJ Wright is not coming back. Pico is like going out of his way to talk about how great the young linebackers are.
Yeah, they hired a skywriter.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
I feel like that was the point that I noticed.
Okay.
Increasingly clear that KJ Wright is not coming back.
Just saying. Do you have any other takeaways from their minicamp? Apparently Daryl Taylor impressed.
They were going to say that Daryl Taylor impressed literally no matter what.
I enjoyed that Bob Condotta quoted a season preview where a scout said that Daryl Taylor needs to be more productive next season than he was last season. He needs to be better than he was last season. It's like, well, he can't possibly be less productive. So you wonder just how closely some of these scouts are paying attention. But I don't know. I don't have much else to say about the Seahawks. I don't get too worked up about anything that happens in June, including reports on Shane Waldron's offense. Although I am enjoying the references to Shane Waldron on the Sean McVay season of Flying Coach.
What is he saying about Shane Waldron?
Just positive stuff. I mean, obviously he's going to say positive stuff, but you know.
He will say, I mean, you could not talk about Shane Waldron. I don't.
Right. You don't have to talk about him. Also, there was a delightful story about Pete Carroll trolling Peter Schrager, who's the other co-host of that podcast. During the first game, he worked as a sideline analyst for Fox and just yelling at him from across the field. I know what you said. I know what you said. And he's like thinking what he might have said on Good Morning Football, the show that he is a co-host on during the week. And it turns out it was nothing, and Pete Carroll was just fucking with him.
Pete Carroll, look, he might not be the best football coach anymore. Might be an antiquated offense. Just a really good hang. You know he is.
Oh, absolutely.
You got to give him that. And really, that's more important than his job of coaching a football team.
Well, on that note...
Thanks for listening. This felt really short.
There wasn't a lot to get to this week.
Concise. We don't even have a hydroplane preview or anything.
I mean, they are starting the season this weekend in Guntersville. I was wondering, like, you know, if all of these football stadiums are reopening at full capacity, we can't do Seafair, really? It's too much Seafair.
But I've got some bad news for you about Seafair.
What's that?
This might have happened anyway.
Oh.
The pandemic might have been a blessing in disguise for Seafairers. Not officially canceling forever for 2 years.
I don't agree with that.
The Blue Angels, are they coming here?
I don't assume so.
Huh.
I have not specifically.
You know, most of the places the Blue Angels go are just fine with whatever. They'll have all the crowds.
That's probably not untrue.
Right? They're based in Atlanta, right?
No, they're based in Pensacola, Florida.
Oh, well, even worse, they're based in a place that have anti-mask mandates.
Oh, no.
Right? Why did I think they were based in Atlanta?
I don't know why you thought they were based in Atlanta. I mean, the only place I've ever seen the Blue Angels besides Seattle is San Francisco. So there were probably pretty similar requirements and restrictions there. Oh, Boeing Air Show at Home. A full virtual performance by the U.S. Blue Angels.
Wow, that sounds like the worst thing I've ever heard in my entire life.
I mean, it's probably just a video. It's fine. It's whatever. But it's not the same. Decidedly not the same.
You're going to be a huge fan of, what's the Van Hagar song, Higher?
I believe so, yes.
They're probably just going to reshow that one.
I don't think they're going to reshow that one. It was the A4 Skyhawk long ago, long before they switched to the FAA-18.
You know they're working, give me fuel, give me fire, give me that which I desire in there.
That is definitely part of the normal soundtrack that's to the shows. But they may have mixed it up in the past 2 years. How would we know?
They haven't.
There was one point they switched it up. Maybe like 2012 or so.
Oh my God. Well, I guess on that note.
Thanks for listening.